If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
In commercial real estate, speed is profit, right? If you recognize an opportunity and you can convince the broker and the sellers that you're there and you're serious, there's way more upside doing that than trying to mess around with single families and trying to sell, going in, waiting for the tenants to leave, going in and rehabbing them, and then, you know, trying to put it on the market and then waiting longer and then their loans. It's too painful. So I let another investor take care of all of that and gave him some meat on the bone so that we both win.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, Derek, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Man, this is exciting. This is the first podcast that I have recorded from the road. So I'm actually sitting in my car vetting a unit in property in Winston-Salem. So I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. Can you give us a quick bio of who you are and what you do?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Derek Clifford. I am a real estate investor based out of the San Francisco Bay Area, and I have a full-time job. And so I buy single families or had bought single families in the past and now transitioning over all to multifamily investing. And I have a podcast. I have a book. I'm just so passionate about the subject that I've been trying to spread the joy to a bunch of other people that are in my situation as well, married W-2 couples. And we have a 36 unit under contract. We own an 18 unit. And I'm in the process of selling all of my single families in my market and putting more of that equity to work in multifamily.
Awesome. Good for you. I mean, you fit perfectly into really the title of our show, which is How to Scale Commercial Real Estate. I would love, really, if you can, to transition. Well, one, before we get to any of those, tell us two things. Shameless plug here. What's the name of your podcast and what's the name of your book?
Awesome. Yeah. So the name of my podcast is Elevate Your Equity. And I do that with my wife. And it's a fantastic show where we interview people from my husband and wife perspective so that the people that are starting out as W-2 married couples may not know where to go or how to start. And so that's really what we kind of focus on with our guests. And then the book that I have is right behind me. It is called, I'm not sure if the video is going to be posted for it is called Part-Time Real Estate Investing for Full-Time Professionals. And it's literally a culmination of all of the questions that I got when I was at my full-time job. Like, how did you do that? Or what do you do here? What do you do there with all this? And so it's a mindset book, plus also, you know, what to expect, how to do single families, and then also what passive investing in multifamily syndications are as well.
Wow, that's a comprehensive undertaking.
Yes, I've tried to make it as visual as possible. I have like 50 figures and stuff in there just to make it really easy for people to be able to look at and get the idea right at a glance, you know, because there's a lot to take in.
That's really cool. One, kudos to you for doing that. I mean, to writing a book is something I think many of us aspire to, but few of us have the diligence to get it done. So what was your timeline on that? How long did that take you to put together?
Took me 30 days.
Holy smokes. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That's really fast.
I had a process. I mean, I don't want to get too far into this unless you're interested, but you start with a mind map, right? You basically put all of the ideas that you want on a piece of paper. Then you build an outline. And then from the outline, you can put how much of the book you want to be in each chapter, right? You build your chapter outlines. And then as soon as you get that, then you kind of back out and say, okay, how quickly do I want to write a book and how long do I want it to be? So if you say, all right, it's got to be 30,000 words, which is the size of my book, that's about 100 pages or so printed on, you know, the double space, like kind of the book formatted paper, then you have to write, you know, 1/30 or 1/30th of that a day, right? So I just had it on my schedule and I just blocked out every single day, you know, about an hour and a half to just sit down and write according to the outline. And the key is to just write because everything's going to get edited anyway. So even if you are struggling with something, you're like, man, I don't know if there's much value here. The key is just to write because there will be things that gets added and subtracted out and your editor's going to handle that for you. So that's pretty much the secret there.
That's awesome. And really your formula there is repeatable, I would think, also when acquiring property. I mean, minus the editor, you know, making the final selections, you know, really, I think that formula is the same. Find your framework, build out what you want it to look like, what you want it to be about, what's your investment thesis, what are you going to put in it, What are the chapters going to be? You know, what type of property are you buying? And then just start filling in the blanks.
You know, in real estate investing, you got to start out with your criteria. You got to get enough research in to understand what it is that you're actually looking for so you can convey that to your team members. Because, you know, if you're not clear on what it is that you want, then how are you going to expect to get clarity back from your team? So that's one thing that I would encourage for listeners to do.
Right. Yeah, I love that. Tell us why you switched out of single family and are now acquiring multifamily.
Yeah, so there's a couple of reasons, but mainly it's because when I first started buying single families, I realized I could only get about 10 of them, at least in my personal name, right? Because at 10, they start maxing out your loans. Like you start to go for another loan, they'll be like, well, you already have 9 mortgages here. Here's the 10th, but we won't be able to underwrite you the next one. There's ways around that. I mean, you can go ahead and get like a commercial loan to refinance out and, you know, cover all those properties. But at the same time, I figured, you know, it takes a lot of effort and energy to get a single family home. And if I just like expand my skill set just a little bit more, multifamily has so much more potential to scale. So that's the second thing. And then the third is financing. Because in multifamily investing, you have the direct ability to impact the value of the building with the things that you do to the building. In single family homes, yes, there's some of that there. You can force appreciate a little bit by like putting in the granite countertops and doing those types of things. But for the most part, you're kind of stuck with appraisals, whatever is around the area. But in multifamily, if you can attract higher rents, right, because of the stuff that you've done to the property, or you can lower your expenses, right, and still keep operations stable, you get the upside from that, you know, 100-fold. And so that's really what was attractive to me was the valuations and the lending and the commercial aspect of properties.
How many single families? What was your max?
Yeah, we were up to about almost 20 at one time. And then we've been systematically selling them all off, mostly in the Indianapolis market, but we have some in Cleveland as well. And so we're just selling those off and really transferring equity over into our multifamily assets.
Right. That's super cool. So let's talk about this deal, because I know you said you've got this deal in Indy, and we were kind of, before we got on air here, it was a really attractive deal. And I would love to kind of hear your soup to nuts, how you package that, the interesting underwriting and financing you were able to acquire, and just how did that deal go down?
Yeah, you know, the way we found this one was super interesting. So I've been trying to work with a broker in Indy for a really long time. And oftentimes, like sometimes it just takes a stroke of luck, right? But preparation meets opportunity. That's luck, right? That's
right.
Or something like that. It's
sure.
Forgot the exact. But what happened was a good friend of mine who we've been wanting to work together for a long time in Indianapolis, we've been looking to try to go direct to sellers. We've been trying to cut the brokers out of the equation. And so we were trying to look up small multifamily owners, anywhere between 25 and 50 units in Indianapolis. And so we had a list, right? And we were just going down the list and we were like looking up the entities, trying to get a hold of the owners and finding out whether or not they want to sell. And we're getting ready to outsource that process. And a couple of days before we had got the VA on board and gotten going, we got a response back from one of the sellers who said, I just listed it with this specific broker. Why don't you talk with them about it? And that was the first time I've ever gotten a response back from a seller. But anyway, when we did, it turns out that that broker I've worked with before. And so I reached out to the broker and said, hey, are you going to let us offer on this thing, right? And he's like, oh, sure. Here's the OM, you know, take a look at it. And then it just kind of went from there. We were able to secure it for the right price. We came in at about maybe $100,000 to $150,000 under asking, because that's just where the numbers seem to make sense. The seller accepted and we're under contract right now.
That's great. I mean, what a great story. So are you continuing using, I mean, because you built out all this marketing, you built your database. I assume you went ahead and hired the VA and you guys are continuing to market for more properties.
Oh, yeah. No, the VA, we're definitely using that right now. And we're just continuing to expand that out right now. But we're very conservative because we understand where we are in the market cycle right now. And so we're very targeted with the types of tenants and properties that we're looking for. So I think that's the key to succeeding in this type of, you know, market right now, is just being very selective and very strong with your underwriting. On the ownership side too, I sold all of my single families, right, in order to make the equity for this thing happen. And then I brought in a few partners or people that I wanted to work with in that market. So I'm the majority owner of that apartment building that we're in contract under right now. And I brought in some extra people that I might want to do business with in the future. So not only am I taking some of my equity in single families and moving it to multifamily, I'm building relationships with the broker, building relationships with potential partners, a property manager, and all these people in this space that's relatively new to me. And that's just kind of how it all starts, is once you get hedged into one market, you can just kind of build from there. So that's where we're at.
Right. I love that, you know, where you said hedged into one market, because there is a lot of value in selecting, I think, one market and really developing your boots on the ground, people that know it. I mean, all of that takes time. And if you're helter skelter across a dozen different markets, it becomes very difficult to implement.
Yeah. You know, we found out too that, like, for agency debt, apparently if you don't have agency experience, or anyone on the ownership team doesn't have agency experience, then you have to issue one waiver for that, right? And right now, where lending is difficult, it's easy now, but the Freddie and the Fannie loans are getting a little bit harder to kind of like make conforming, and it's taking longer to close.
Right.
The less waivers, the better. If we can just get ourselves more multifamily experience and then build that up that way, in any one market, you can call yourself, you know, once you refinance into Freddie or Fannie debt, then that will help you move forward with your next deal. So getting that experience and the track record in one market is super, super important, because then you can use that as leverage in other markets once you're established.
Right. Yeah, I like that. Talk to us about that financing that you acquired for this.
Yeah, so we were really lucky on this. We actually had, we'd used this bank before on another multifamily that I'm on with some other partners as well. Mm. But sometimes, you know, the broker and the loan broker were both telling me, look, you know, it's very unlikely that you're going to be getting Freddie, because this property is just severely under market rents and the underwriting criteria is going to be really difficult to meet. So we highly recommend that you go with bank. And so we tried agency debt anyway. And because of all those reasons, you know, you had the agency debt issue, you have non-qualified or not very good financials provided from the seller. So you have to have like all of these waivers, right, to try to get this product together for the loan. So we just went with a loan product that we've used before on another property. And it's amazing. This local credit union was able to give us a 4% loan with 2 years of interest only, 20% down, and they rolled in all of the construction costs, which is about $250,000 into that loan. So all we had to do was make sure that we brought 20% of the total cost together to the table, which means that our cash requirement on this guy was really, really small, a lot less than we thought. So the amount of money that I brought in for 1031 equated to even more equity. So it's just a win-win that financing piece helps create more equity for the partners, right? For less dollars.
Right. That's amazing. 2 years of IO, 4%, they're covering construction costs. Yeah, that's really cool. And that's something you would not, if you had gotten it, would have been a lot harder on a single family, I would think.
Oh yeah, for sure. All of my single families, like I bought them back in 2017, 2018. And so I had rates on those at like, you know, 4.5%, 5%, sometimes over 5% on each of those. And now we're rolling ourselves into a product where we're at 4%, but the cash on cash is so much higher because we're putting so much less into the property, right, in order to close it. So, and then we expect to be able to refinance out later into debt that's a little bit lower interest rate and a little bit longer term as well, with a longer amortization as well.
That's really cool. Why is this property under market rent?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. Mismanagement. 100% mismanagement. The owner's daughter is trying to manage the property all the way from California, and that's like 2,000 miles away. So there's one on-site resident manager that's there, and things just aren't getting done. And so in order to counteract the vacancy factor, right, they're basically keeping the rents very low to keep people in the building. Whereas we're going to be hiring a professional property manager, right, who can run all these things for us and be our boots on the ground and eyes and ears. That way our expenses are capped, but our income is not. And so when we run the numbers, it works out to be so much better doing it that way rather than doing it the way that they are.
So you've got $250,000 in CapEx. Will you be able to raise rents before you do your repairs?
Yes, because they're already under market rents, even as is right now. Like I think the average rent thing is like $550 per door. And as it is right now, we should be able to bring it up to 625. And then with a little bit more like, you know, oomph in there, like if we replace some of the carpeting or with LVP or tile, and then, you know, repaint some of the cabinets, we're sure that we can get up to 650 to even 675 on these, because they're pretty big units. They're like 700 to 800 square foot units.
That's really cool. Good for you. So maybe in the end, you might not even need all of your CapEx. And if that happens, then you can juice your returns even more.
That makes for some very happy partners, which means you've got some good possibilities coming down the road when people are motivated for the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. Bringing great wins or bringing investors along for great wins makes them very eager to wash, rinse, repeat. That's for sure. Tell me about your partnership structure. Or is everybody else in the deal just passive investors, or are they active with you, or what's that look like?
Yeah, you know, good question. Like, we wanted to do this as a syndication, right? Where we had limited partners and we had, you know, like class A, class B shares, right? In the end, we decided that it would probably be better as a joint venture because I was bringing already 50% of the cash requirements to the table. And all we needed was a few other guys to, you know, round out some of the rest of the funding. And because of one of the people that's investing with us is outside of the country, and I'm using a 1031 exchange in order to get into this, we're doing what's called a tenants in common structure. Everyone's got their own stake on title in the property. So I'm able to use my 1031 funds from my personal portfolio and my personal name. And I don't know if you knew this, but you can also change, as long as the tax basis is the same, you can change title. So I could change the title from my personal name to a disallowed LLC on this property. And so that's what I'm actually doing. But that only happens if you can do tenants in common, you know, and keep your equity slice the same.
Got it. I'm not sure I tracked on why that's beneficial.
Oh, yeah. So I did a 1031 exchange when I sold all of my properties, right? So when I bought them for like an average of, this is back in 2017 or 2018. I bought those properties for like an average of, I don't know, $50,000 to $60,000 a door. And then I was selling them for double that, you know, this year, right? Instead of paying taxes on those, I'm basically rolling them into a disallowed LLC, which means the LLC's tax reporting purposes goes to my social security number, like I had when I was, you know, buying those single families instead of a TIN number. So I still get some of the legal protections, but for tax purposes, it's still me. It's a single member LLC disallowed. And so I'll be able to roll it into that LLC to hold title in tenants in common on this joint venture with three other guys.
And you'd only be able to do that if it's a tenants in common deal.
That's right. Yep.
That's nuance.
Yeah, because I mean, if you don't do that, right, then your funds are kind of commingled with another outside entity with other people in it. So the only way to keep it straight is the tenants in common. Plus, we also had an international investor as well, someone from Canada who wanted to be into this deal. And for them, if without a tenants in common type of structure, they would have double taxation, because if we had one entity, then they'd have to pay taxes in Canada for collecting income from an LLC there, and then also the US taxes as well.
That's brutal. Yeah. I've got one more question for you on your 1031. Was the 1031, because you know you had up to 20 properties, and I don't know how many of those you rolled into this deal. Well, let's start there. How many was that?
It was like 8.
Okay. You rolled 8 of them in. Were those all individually owned, or was that a portfolio loan on that 8 so that you could then just carry all of those proceeds over quickly without getting caught in all of the, you know, traps that come along with 1031s?
Okay. So those were held in my personal name with an umbrella insurance policy. So just for those of those listeners out there, right, like make sure if you're going to do something like this and you're holding properties in your personal name, I don't really recommend, you know, doing that, but you got to start somewhere, right, at some point. And so that's the easiest way to get loans, especially if you have a high income job, right, is to get some properties, right, with their own insurance and then add a layer of umbrella insurance as well to protect you from the liabilities that may come up. Yeah, we sold those. And because I have a large network of individuals that I know and trust in Indy, there was an investor, once I broadcast out that I may be selling these, who like got in contract with me in 2 days. And we quickly agreed on a price, because for me, what was important was this property and not keeping those. So yeah, I could have squeezed out like maybe $5,000 more per property if I had sold them off individually. But I realized that like in commercial real estate, speed is profit, right? If you recognize an opportunity and you can convince the broker and the sellers that you're there and you're serious, there's way more upside doing that than trying to mess around with single families and trying to sell, going in, waiting for the tenants to leave, going in and rehabbing them, and then, you know, trying to put it on the market and then waiting longer than their loans. It's too painful. So I let another investor take care of all of that and gave him some meat on the bone so that we both win.
Right. So he was able to close, or she was able to close all 8 of those right away.
Yeah.
So you got all the cash at once, because I know you've got, what is it, 45 days once? Once, of course, you've never taken constructive receipt of fund. Maybe whoever your 1031 person was that handled that for you. So they give you all the money, and then you got 45 days to identify your next asset. But you already had it identified.
I already had it identified. We're already under contract. So I found the property first, and then I realized, oh, you know what? If I do, instead of selling off my individual properties, I'm only going to net like, you know, 100K, 150K after taxes. But if I do a 1031 exchange, then I may be able to get over 200K, which is what ended up happening, and then use that to invest in this property to give me more equity by deferring my taxes, right? And so that's what we did. So we saw the deal. We got it under contract, right? And because we had like, I think 70 days or so to close on it from a financing, once we got under contract, right, with the property, we had some time to be able to figure out. And normally, like, I don't recommend people go and try to sell their single family portfolios within that tight of a time frame. But sure. Because I had a network of folks that I trusted out there and they were out there, they were looking at stuff real quick. I gave them some incentive to move fast, which was more meat on the bone, which means I wasn't asking for an insane price, right?
Right.
He was able to win and I was able to win doing that formula.
Right. Yeah. You made a good point there that the speed of the money is often worth more than the cost of it.
I think that's the word of the day, man. That's beautiful.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's right. Let's jump here into the final four. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Yeah, I think that the key to any success is consistency. So blocking out some time somewhere, right, on your calendar to be able to devote to real estate investing, no matter where it is and wherever you are, right? If you're starting in single families, awesome. You know, make sure you're doing that every single day. You got to build momentum up because if you're not consistent, you're not going to get there. And so even if you're in the education stage where you're like, I don't even know how to even approach all this, well, dedicate that 1 hour to reading books or to talking with investors or to going on Bigger Pockets and kind of asking questions. That consistency of 1 hour a day is what held me to get to where I am over the course of many years.
That's awesome. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
Yeah. So nutrition is huge. Hydration, nutrition. There's this thing, Sam, have you heard of the 75 hard? Have you heard of that
before? I have. Yeah. That sounds brutal.
Yeah. So my wife and I completed that a couple of months ago and that's changed ever because that is like the ultimate in peak, like mental performance. It's more about willpower than it is about like time or anything else. So I think getting seriously, seriously mentally tough, that's key there.
Right. No, yeah, I've talked to actually on this podcast, I've interviewed a few people who have said they're in the middle of it. And yeah, hats off to you, man. That's
great.
That's impressive. Let's see. Number three is, when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
Yeah, so my wife and I, we like to give back and volunteer our time to some local monasteries in our area. And also, I'd like to talk with investors who are just starting out too. You know, so people contact me all the time with like, hey, how did you get going on this? I love Clubhouse as well. So just kind of giving my time in Clubhouse and just trying to help people get inspired about what real estate investing can enable for people that come from my background, from a full-time working place, right? Most people don't even understand that there's a whole nother way to approach life out there that doesn't involve working a W-2 job, you know?
Right.
And so getting to that point where the light bulb goes off, like I live for that moment. And so I really do everything I can, even if I'm doing it for free. That's really where I like to be.
Right. That's awesome. Derek, if a listener's want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah. So the best way to do that is to go onto our website at elevateequity.org. And then there's a place where they can schedule some time to meet with me or check out all of our material. We've got blogs and podcasts, and also check us out on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, even. It's called Elevate Your Equity. So you should just be able to Google that and have it come up. Or last thing is they can check out our book. It's a part-time real estate investing for full-time professionals. And you can find that on Amazon just by typing my name into the search bar, Derek Clifford. That should come up. Or you can get in touch with me and I'll be happy to get you connected that way as well.
Awesome. Derek, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Yeah. And thank you, Sam. I know how busy you are today. So I appreciate you taking some time in your mobile studio.
That's right, man. That's right. Well, get her done. I appreciate it.
You got it, man. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.